Astronomy Cast, episode 20 for Monday, January 22nd, 2007. What we learn from the American Astronomical Society. Welcome to Astronomy Cast, your weekly facts-based journey through the cosmos, where we help you understand not only what we know, but how we know what we know. My name is Fraser Kane. I'm the publisher of Universe Today, and with me is Dr. Pamela Gay, a professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Hi, Pamela.
Hey, Fraser.
We've been sort of leading up to this. We've mentioned it, that we were going to do it, and now I think we're ready. So I think we're going to be able to let people hear some of the interviews that you did at the American Astronomical Society.
That sounds like a great plan. I was able to talk to some really great people and learn a lot about areas of science that my own research never even touches on, and find out about things that are actually invalidating parts of the textbook that I teach out of. And it's always fun to be able to turn to my students and say, today I found out your textbook is currently out of date.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of the subjects, you know, supernova and dark matter and dark energy, and this is all the latest stuff. So I'm hoping that people have heard all the episodes. They'll be able to kind of put it all into context and go, oh, okay, I understand now from this point of view. So I think all of the stuff we'll be talking about today, we've actually covered the basics in previous shows. So,
and now we get to update and invalidate ourselves all at the same time.
Perfect. All right, so we are incorrect. We're out of date. So what's first?
Well, the very first really cool press conference of the meeting had a group from the Cosmos Survey. Cosmos, in this case, is actually an acronym for the Cosmic Evolution Survey. They used a bunch of different telescopes, Hubble, XMM Newton, Spitzer Keck, the Very Large Telescope in Chile, and the Very Large Radio Telescope Array in New Mexico, and the Subaru Telescope, and just about every telescope on the planet, it seemed like, to, in detail, measure the distribution of matter that we can see, luminous matter, and the distribution of dark matter. And they had some really cool results that I was able to get Richard Massey, a postdoc in the project, to describe straight for our listeners.
All right, well, let's hear what he has to say.
So what we've revealed in our map of the dark matter distribution is that it makes up a filamentary large-scale structure, rather like a sponge, in that all the dark matter is distributed along a series of very long filaments which meet in massive clumps of dark matter and surround enormous voids in cosmic space. Now, this is absolutely vital in terms of the baryonic or ordinary matter and helping it evolve into the forms that we see around us today. It's vital in two ways. Firstly, the sheer amount of the stuff of it holds the universe together as it's trying to expand away from the Big Bang. By its own gravity, it keeps everything compact and in a place where it can later go on to form galaxies and stars. As a second point, the dark matter is also vital because it has a crucial lead time over the ordinary matter in its gravitational collapse from a smooth universe at the Big Bang, which we see in the cosmic microwave background. This gradually transitions into a more clumpy, filamentary distribution where the matter is more compactly represented in space. So the dark matter begins this collapse first and therefore forms an underlying scaffold, which is absolutely vital for the baryonic matter to later flow into this scaffolding. And it's very much like scaffolding as you would build a house. The dark matter goes up first around the outside, and then the baryons with which we know and understand, these later flow into that scaffolding and are slowly, gradually constructed into the galaxies, stars and planets that we find around ourselves today.
Can you tell us anything about, are the peaks the same between the baryonic and dark matter? Are there offsets? What new things have we learned about the distribution?
So generally, the distribution of the dark matter and the baryonic matter are very strongly correlated. In other words, wherever there's dark matter, in general, there is some baryonic matter. And that's very much in line with the theoretical expectations which were made in advance of this new map. So overall, it really provides a very strong confirmation of those theories that we really understand what's going on large scales. Having said that, there are a couple of discrepancies in the distribution of baryons and dark matter. So in some places there is dark matter and no baryons, and in others vice versa. Now, although fundamentally this map is really at the limits of image analysis techniques, and it's really pushing the bounds of what we're able to measure, so it's slightly noisy. However, I don't necessarily want to believe all of these discrepancies, but they offer a really tantalizing glimpse into differences in behavior in the dark matter and normal matter that may provide a clue as to its nature. So the first question that we've answered is where it is. In answering what it is, these discrepancies might provide some insight by the different ways that they interact with each other and consequently the different places that they end up.
Does this completely rule out forever the fact that gravity might have some additional modified term, or are you simply saying there has to be dark matter, but gravity can still be modified?
So this result, and others like it using this technique of gravitational lensing, now provide mounting evidence that there is definitely some sort of dark matter in the universe, some additional missing mass over the baryons that we can interact with and that we can see, breathe, feel and touch around us. There is definitely something else there. Now, of course, this doesn't rule out the fact that there might be other theories of gravity which might also be true. So these initial theories were brought in initially to explain various mounting evidence a couple of decades ago that there is missing mass in the universe. Now, people suppose that either there is missing mass and that therefore some of it is made up by dark matter, or perhaps that the theories of gravity are wrong. We've found that there is definitely missing mass and definitely dark matter, but this doesn't say anything necessarily about the possibility that there might be both.
Well, that was great. Good job on getting that on that interview. So what's the next piece of research that you were able to look into?
Well, a little bit later in the conference, they had basically what turned into a supernova roundup of great explosive discoveries in our universe. And Dr. Stephen P. Reynolds from North Carolina State University presented on a supernova remnant that's near and dear to a lot of people, the Kepler supernova remnant. This is a large nebula that can be seen that was formed in an explosion that was observed by the Kepler who figured out how planets move and all that sort of neat stuff. And in studying this supernova, he found that our understanding of when the elements needed to form planets were released into the universe may be wrong. And our understanding of exactly what types of stars can become white dwarfs may also be wrong. And he took the time to sit down and explain all of his research and all of its repercussions to our understanding right for our listeners.
All right, well, let's listen to this one.
I'm here with Stephen Reynolds, a professor of physics at North Carolina State University. This morning he did a wonderful presentation on how type 1a supernovas aren't exactly everything we ever thought they were. Could you sum up the results for us?
Short answer is that the nearest supernova well observed from Earth in 1604 has left a remnant which seems to have characteristics of both the type 1a supernovae exploding white dwarfs and the single massive stars that leave their surroundings full of dense circumstellar material. Kepler's supernova remnant appears to be a type 1a supernova that also left behind lots of stuff, indicating that its progenitor was perhaps more massive than the common run-of-the-mill type 1a supernova.
Now, this is a supernova that people have clearly known about since, well, Kepler was around. Why is it that it's taken so long for forensic astronomy to make a clear determination on the type of supernova that created this object?
Well, it's useful to remember first that the whole idea of supernovae is only about 80 years old. The idea of type 1 and type 2 is about 50 years old. The realization that the type 1s were partly massive stars that had lost their hydrogen and partly exploding white dwarfs is only about 20 years old. So it's really only been a puzzle for about 20, 25 years, because it's X-ray astronomy that helps you make the distinction, and we've only had X-ray astronomy as well for about that long. So, and then after that, why didn't we face up to it sooner? Well, it took a while to accumulate optical, X-ray, and other kinds of information. So it's probably been a puzzle for about 10 years, and the reason we didn't settle it sooner is because, well, we're scientists are conservative, and most type 1As do not seem to show this circumstellar material, and so the conventional wisdom was if either it didn't have it or it had it, if it had it, it wasn't a type 1A. So we have just been forced by the data to say, yes, it is a 1A with that.
What were the lines of evidence that you used to clearly state, forever and always we hope, that this is a type 1a supernova remnant?
Well, we're very fortunate. Exploding massive star cooks lots of elements, but the densest ones wind up trapped in the neutron star left behind, and the material that's ejected into space tends to have pretty well agreed upon patterns of heavy elements. For instance, lots of oxygen and some iron, but not very much, whereas the exploding white dwarfs produce mostly iron, so that the ratio of oxygen to iron atoms is less than 1 for type 1a. For a core collapse supernova, that ratio is predicted to be 70. So even astronomers should be able to tell the difference between 0.7 and 70. So that's what we did. We looked for the oxygen, which we couldn't find. We looked for the iron, which was everywhere.
Type 1a supernova, they're one of our standard candles that we use to measure the universe. if they aren't all exactly the same, what sorts of evidence can we look for in spectra to say that the ones we're using as standard candles are still trustworthy standard candles, even though we have these other type 1A things that are slightly different?
Well, two answers to that. First one, the reason that 1As have suddenly become so useful is because people realized that they weren't quite exactly the same. This was already realized. Purely observationally, it was found starting in the early 90s that the ones that were slightly brighter also lasted slightly longer. Their light faded a little more slowly. So nobody knew why this was exactly. They had some ideas, but just observationally, the brighter, the slower. The faster, the slightly dimmer. And so that people were able to use that to correct a little bit, and it's that extra correction that gave us the leverage to learn the wonderful things that we've learned. Now, we don't know yet whether the actual explosion of a white dwarf that originated from a more massive progenitor would be different, but and if it were, whether it would, if it obeyed the same relation, if it was brighter but also slower decaying, then that's already taken care of. What would scare us is if it turned out to be rather different, that it was brighter but its decay rate mimicked a fainter one. Then we would really be in trouble, because these would be the first type 1As that the universe could produce, because their progenitors evolve faster. And what you really don't want is a systematic effect with distance, so that the ones that seem to be farthest away, that occurred the earliest, are systematically different in a way that mimics a different kind of supernova. What we are asserting is that the progenitor of that white dwarf, rather than being a star with maybe two solar masses, which could take a billion years from its birth to producing the white dwarf, might have had six or seven solar masses. Still not enough to become a core collapse supernova, but enough to have evolved considerably faster, and it would have to lose all that extra material, which we think happens, and that would be surrounding it. So the white dwarf is still only 1.4 plus one atom mass, but its progenitor was more massive and rapidly evolving. So basically, this is early days in this. We don't know whether we are learning about all the mechanism for all 1As, and we just happen to have a system that is able to show us that better, or whether the explosion itself is characteristically different. So we hope that if we find it's different, we will also find an imprint, so that when we observe actual supernovae in distant galaxies, we'll say, aha, this is one of these massive guys, we'll leave it out of the sample. We don't know yet what that signature might be, or even if we'll need one.
So what are you hoping to find to use to build on these results, perhaps in new explosions, and what data do you need to better secure your results?
Well, the first thing is, we have barely scratched the surface with this astonishing Kepler data set. We have 30 million X-ray photons, each polished and cherished and focused within a half an arc second by the splendid Chandra telescopes, each whose energy has been measured, and we will be working for years just on analyzing Kepler's data and bringing it closer to the predictions of models.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Reynolds. Any parting words that you want to pass on to our audience?
Let me take the opportunity to point out one additional important feature of this. And we live on a planet which is largely iron. It would be interesting to know how soon the universe could make iron. Well, if a significant number of type 1A supernovae can live their lives out and explode in 100 million rather than a billion years, the universe started making heavy elements that could turn into planets and people 10 times sooner than we thought. And that's just the next time you see a little green man, he might be older than you had conceived.
Great. All right, well, that was good. That's two down. What's the third one?
Well, in that same press conference, Dr. Nathan Smith, a postdoc at the University of California, Berkeley, reported on these little blue stars that in all reality are giant blue variables that have nebula around them that look suspiciously identical to the nebula that we find around the supernova remnant 1987A. And he found that these blue stars, which we didn't think were likely to go supernova, just might be likely to go supernova. And he talked to us about what this means to our understanding of stellar evolution.
Right. In 1987A, that was the one that went off in the Magellan clouds back in 87.
Magellanic clouds.
Yeah.
Named after Magellan, the explorer.
Right.
Yeah. And it was the first supernova that we were able to get really good images prior to the supernova, entirely by accident. We were imaging these nearby galaxies because they're nearby and easy to study. And then a supernova went off. So we had all these images to go back and study what the star looked like right before the supernova. And we built all these Rube Goldberg experiment type theories to try and figure out how this star went supernova, because it wasn't something we expected to explode. And this new research by Dr. Smith and his collaborators shows that, well, maybe our initial understanding was wrong, and maybe more stars than we ever imagined are capable of just exploding.
Well, don't give everything away. Let's hear what he has to say.
Okay, here he goes. I'm here with Nathan Smith, a postdoc at the University of California, Berkeley, and he has some fascinating new results that may just change our view of how giant stars end their lives and may have some implications on Eta Carina. So could you sum up your results for us?
Well, what we've done is we've discovered a few new stars with circumstellar nebulae around them. And this is material that's ejected before the star explodes. And these nebulae look very similar to 1987A in terms of their geometry. They have a bipolar geometry where they're ejecting material out of their poles, but they also have an equatorial ring, a very prominent ring. And the similarity of these nebulae to the nebula that was around supernova 1987A has important implications about what that star might have been doing before it exploded. And in particular, it draws into question one of the prevailing models for how the 1987A circumstellar nebula might have formed and what that star might have been doing before it exploded.
Can you tell us a little bit about what made 1987A such a unique and exciting case, especially since it was so close?
Right. It was the nearest supernova in about 400 years that had been well observed. And this wonderful data that we were able to obtain for 1987A showed more detail, and it was the best observed supernova ever. And what we learned from that is that we had data that existed before the supernova went off. And this had never been seen before at that time with any kind of supernova. So astronomers were able to identify the star on images before it exploded that were taken, you know, a decade before. And it was found that it was a blue supergiant, which contradicted most of what the common wisdom was at the time, that a star should reach the stage of a red supergiant and then explode.
Now, as some of our listeners may remember, in an earlier episode, we discussed how supernova come to happen, and we discussed that stars like Eta Carina, they end their lives as these giant stars that suddenly start blowing off these really hot winds as a Wolf-Rayet star, and then they finally basically explode in their final death throes. Now, this was a star that under normal models would have gone through that phase, but now you're seeing that they're basically exploding much earlier and not going through this phase. What implications does this have for our understanding of stellar evolution for these giant stars?
Yeah, these other objects we've discovered are, at least one of them is known to be a luminous blue variable, and the other ones may be going through a phase that's analogous to it. And first of all, the nebulae that are ejected are formed during this LBV phase, and they must be formed in a different way that has been proposed for supernova 1987A, which required transition through a red supergiant phase to a blue supergiant, and it had to involve a merger to spin up the star to create this kind of geometry. But now we're seeing these other stars do that without this mechanism, without a merger, and without passing through a red supergiant phase. And so if the similarity of their nebulae to 1987A suggests that they may also be poised to explode, they might be in the final throes of their life, that suggests that we could be looking to these stars, these luminous blue variables, as possible progenitors of supernovae. And the reason that is something new is because when we study the chemical abundances of the nebulae around LBVs, and we think about their place in stellar evolution, they're supposed to be at the end of core hydrogen burning, which is the first stage of burning, and not yet at the more advanced stages, which are required before the star can suffer a core collapse. So this means that they're blowing up, or if they do potentially explode, that means that they're blowing up much sooner than we thought.
Does this imply that the opportunity that someone alive today just might observe a supernova in the nearby universe has now gone up somewhat?
Oh, you mean for Eta Carina? Well, I'm certainly hoping so. I'm planning on that one exploding near the end of my career.
So we no longer have to wait for Eta Carina to become a Wolf-Rayet star. It just might go. Now, these other stars that you're observing, are they also in the they just might go category?
Well, the thing is, we don't know. I mean, the evolution of these massive stars is still very uncertain because they span a wide range of masses and they're very rare. So we only have a few examples with which to try and piece together the complete picture, and that's very difficult. And it doesn't just depend on the initial mass. It also depends on the rotation rate. It depends on the chemical abundances when the star was born. And it can depend on whether or not there was a companion star. So all of these variables figure into the equation in different ways. And it may be the case that even two stars that start their life with the same mass because of these other properties with different rotation rates or chemical abundances might have end fates that are different. In other words, a star that would normally with the initial mass that would reach a Wolf-Rayet phase after the luminous blue variable phase may not get there. So the two stars in the same place in this the HR diagram that we have, which is the, you know, tells us about stellar evolution, two stars that look the same might, one might blow and the other one might have to wait another 100,000 years. So we don't know.
With all the neat things that you're finding with these very surprising objects, what is the thing that has startled you the most in this discovery?
Well, the I guess it's the variety of different possible end states of these stars. It's so phenomenally complicated, or at least it seems that way, maybe because we have there are so few examples. And as we get, you know, as we continue to study these objects, we get more and more examples of them. And another part that's related to that is the variety may be caused by how fast transitions happen. For Eta Carina, for example, when we look at the chemical abundance of material further away from the star, we see that the chemical abundances have changed. The pattern of chemical abundances that have been ejected in the last 1,000 years have gone from normal composition, like our sun, to something that's very enriched in nitrogen. So these things can change very fast. And it's giving us clues that maybe, you know, the normal pictures of slowly transitioning from one stage to the next are not the norm, but maybe the episodic mass ejection is maybe more the norm.
Thanks a lot for spending the time talking to us, Nathan. Do you have anything that, in summary, you'd like to say out to our audience?
Well, I guess we should keep an eye on some of these stars, these massive stars, because if some of these close by ones do go off, they're going to be spectacular events. If they're in the northern hemisphere, there are a few of these objects we've discovered. If they do explode as supernovae, they'll be the brightest thing you've seen in a long time. So it's something to keep a lookout for.
But we here on Earth are in absolutely no danger because they're all more than the n parsecs that you have to worry about.
I wouldn't say that necessarily. Eta Carina is only 2 kiloparsecs away. And if it were to explode in a very energetic supernova, something like a hypernova, we're probably going to be safe. But likely what would happen is that the X-ray blast from the supernova might disable all of our satellites. This happened recently with some coronal mass ejections from the sun, and some satellites were disrupted. But the X-ray blasts from this explosion would actually have a serious effect on our communications. And if we were unlucky enough to have the pole of the star aimed at us in a gamma-ray burster type event, that could, some people have suggested that that type of event may periodically cause mass extinctions on the Earth. And whether or not that's true is debatable. And luckily, though, it looks like Eta Carina's pole is not aimed at us, so we're probably safe.
So humans are safe, our atmosphere protects us from the UV, but Lord help all of the satellites in orbit?
Something like that, yeah.
Thanks a lot, Nathan. It's been great talking with you.
Okay, great, thanks.
Okay, great work, Pamela. Thanks for getting out there and putting the microphone in people's face and getting the research right from them.
It was my pleasure. It's really fun to get to talk to people about what they're doing instead of just reading about what they do in journal articles.
Now, next week, as we sort of threatened a couple of weeks ago, we're going to do the Repercussions of the Black Hole episode. As predicted, our mailbox is filled up with questions about black holes, both clarifications and just like what ifs. So I think we'll try and queue up a bunch of those for next week and get through them. You ready for that?
I'm going to try and be ready for that.
There's some pretty interesting questions, so yeah, I think it'll be black holes always make people's heads scratch their heads, so I think it'll be good. All right, so you can get more information about AstronomyCast on our website. It's astronomycast.com. You can send us any comments, questions, or feedback to info@astronomycast.com. You can join the discussion forum. There's a link beside every show. We've also added a new player on the website, so you can play the shows directly from the website. You don't need an iPod, just click the little play button beside any episode and you can just listen to it. But if you do have a portable music player, like an iPod, you can subscribe to the show by pointing your podcatching software to astronomycast.com/podcast.xml or just search for our show on iTunes. All right, thanks, Pamela. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, see you later, Fraser. This has been AstronomyCast, a weekly fact-based journey through the cosmos. Music provided by Travis Searle.